Why Miami is still a favorite place for the wealthy to hide their money. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
You know, the old saying that dark things happen in places that are dark. Well, that's exactly what we found.
First, it was the Panama Papers. Now it's the Pandora Papers. Millions of documents that show how many of the world's super wealthy hide their wealth. We'll learn why Miami is a hotspot for stashing cash. Also, Miami-Dade officials are redrawing county districts. What will that mean for the voters? And a look at how fish waste might help save seagrass and coral. Plus, a small West Palm Beach farm feeding low-income communities might soon be closing down. The city wants to replace it with housing. All of that today on Sundial After the News. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Famous singers, movie stars, athletes hide their money using South Florida real estate. Presidents, barons, even the Vatican found to funnel money through the U.S. and other offshore accounts to hide their actions. All of this has been revealed by the Pandora Papers, and many of those stories are being published by the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. You can find a link to some of those stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Now, earlier this morning, we spoke with a couple of the reporters who have sifted through so many of those documents. Kevin Hall is the North American editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and Antonio Delgado covers Venezuela for El Nuevo Herald. So, Kevin, how would you describe the importance of the Pandora Papers and compared to the release of the Panama Papers a few years ago?
I think you look at it as an evolution, and what it's allowed reporters who've worked on all these projects to do is kind of have a building block to kind of build stories off your earlier stories. If you're looking at bad guy X from Venezuela, and he was in the Panama Papers for this, but then he's got a suspicious activity report over here, and now you're finding he's also got a, you know, companies in Panama with alcohol, you know, so it gives you kind of a stepping stone, so to speak, to kind of get you closer and closer to closing that circle on particular bad guy you might be looking at.
You know, again, these papers, these documents shared by a lot of different journalists and agencies to go through them. Antonio, when you're going through all this, when you're scanning through this, what were you thinking about? What are you looking for specifically? How did you do it?
Well, I mean, you start with a list of people you want to track down. In the case of Venezuelan kleptocrats, we have a long list of the usual suspects, people that we investigated before, and we're trying to find new piece for the puzzle. We put them together. We search around. And you start with names. And then from that, you might be able to get emails where they're mentioned. You might be able to get specific information about shell companies they open, letters from those shell companies to their lawyers and so on. And you just keep getting pieces of the puzzle. And with that, you start arming a picture, and you might be able to determine this is something new. There might be a story out of this. Or some of those pieces sometimes pointed to information that has already been made public.
Yeah. Kevin, what was the most surprising thing you found?
Well, I'm not sure there was anything that kind of jumped out as wildly surprising. I think it's more of the same on steroids. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise, but it still always is that, you know, you get to look in on places where nobody's looking in, right? You know, the old saying that dark things happen in places that are dark. Well, that's exactly what we found.
Kevin, how often did Miami and South Florida pop up in the documents that you looked at?
I spent a lot of time looking at everybody at Fisher Island, and you search under Miami, but then you narrow that down. You do paired searches, Miami and a suspicious activity report, Miami and fraud, and you know, then you kind of dig through the documents that way because they're searchable, but also then breaking it down to Fisher Island, Indian Creek, Sunny Isles, and so we have, you know, we have some pretty good information that we've built that we didn't put into a story, but at some point will go to use because there's just a phenomenal amount of people from all over the place, many of whom are just completely anonymous or people who are nothing particularly notable or illicit.
And I wondered, Kevin, you know, did the Pandora Papers just show us what a lot of people assumed, which is wealthy people just want to hide their money, whether it's for tax reasons or they just want to hide. They don't want anybody to know what they have, because I'm wondering, like, from the Pandora Papers, how many of those people are just regular wealthy people trying to hide stuff and criminals or people doing criminal activity?
Well, I mean, the big answer is we don't know, right? Because it's not a crime to have these things. It's a crime to not declare certain things with tax authorities. So one of the dynamics, Latin America actually makes up a large portion, more than half, I believe, of all the documents in the Pandora Papers. And in Latin America, you have two things. You have places that have confiscatory tax regimes, right? So Argentina or Venezuela or Ecuador, places where they might, you know, the top tax rate, if you're an ultra wealthy person, might be 60%. Well, nobody actually pays that 60%. Instead, it kind of drives people into this offshore space. So part of the dynamic is you have either, you know, failed governments or tax regimes that kind of incentivize that. And then you've got a separate set of people who are just from unstable places that, you know, if you're an Argentine and you've gone through so many currency collapses, wouldn't you want to, if you're able to, have your money in dollars and outside of your country? And, you know, that applies for a lot of the Latin countries, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So those two dynamics. But ultimately, Americans, you know, one of the big criticisms and allegations, oh, the CIA or somebody must be behind this because there are no Americans in here. Well, the American tax code is set up to the benefit of the very wealthy, right? They don't have wage income, they have investment income. That's taxed at a much, much lower rate. Although I do feel pretty sure that if you had Delaware leaks, if somehow somebody got in and got the whole registry of Delaware, that you'd find many of the same things. You'd find mostly people who don't seem to have an identifiable problem, but you'd probably find a lot of Russians and others who are using Delaware companies to hide assets somewhere else. It's the anonymity that's the issue.
Yeah. Speaking with Kevin Hall, North American editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Also, Antonio Delgado of El Nuevo Herald. He specializes in Venezuelan issues and corruption. We're talking about the Pandora Papers, millions of documents that show how the super wealthy hide their money in offshore accounts, or even here in the United States, and how some are using Miami real estate to protect that money. Again, sometimes just to hide their money, sometimes to hide from taxes, sometimes for criminal reasons. You can find a full link, by the way, to the full investigation, all the stories that have been published, because again, El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald have been all over this and other news organizations. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, so I keep talking about the fact that you have a lot of different wealthy people who popped up in these Pandora Papers. Antonio, one of them, famous singer Julio Iglesias. What did you learn from, you know, the Pandora Papers about how Mr. Iglesias, you know, is hiding his money? What's he doing?
Well, it is surprising. He has many properties in South Florida, including at least four big lots in Indian Creek Island. It's one of the most expensive pieces of real estate, not only in South Florida, but the United States. It's called the billionaire's bunker. Some of these properties were hidden behind shell companies opening in Panama and other and the Virgin Islands mainly.
So you have people creating shell companies, and they do it so that they don't have to list who's running the company or who owns these properties. That's how they hide, right?
Yes, it is one thing to have a property under Julio Iglesias' name, another under a company's name whose nobody knows that exists. So that's the best way.
I mean, you have Julio Iglesias, another one that came up, Shakira, the pop star, the Latin pop star. What are they doing with the shell companies? Is it just to hide their money from tax for tax purposes, or is there something else?
Well, it could be just to not to have the properties directly under their names. There might be a lot of benefits for doing that, and for legitimate reasons, it must be said. But the thing is, when you have not only artists, but you also have may have like Latin American politicians hiding property worth millions of dollars, not under their own names, you got a question: where did that money come from, and why they're hiding that? We found in the Pandora Papers the name of three different presidents, and they were legitimate businessmen and very rich people before they won elections. But you also have ministers that have property here in South Florida, which you would they'd be hard pressed to be able to explain how they were able to afford those properties.
Yeah, and you know what, Kevin, one story I wanted to get to that I found interesting. This is about it's a tie to the Vatican. The story of Enrico Caso and his link to a Vatican cardinal that's in trouble right now, and there's a link to from them to some Miami real estate. Briefly, just help me understand how is the Vatican linked to this Miami real estate in the Pandora Papers?
It's a real roundabout story. The Vatican, the highest ranking Vatican insider to be charged, was charged last year, Cardinal Angelo Besseo, if I'm pronouncing that right. And he was defrocked by Pope Francis for alleged embezzlement. Most of it involves a $400 million roughly property in London, a Harrods warehouse that's going to be turned into luxury housing. And a lot of this money, actually, that the Vatican invests in things like that actually comes from Peter's Pence, which is, since the 1860s, has been a fund from the common giver at the church that funnels to the Vatican. So there's something odd in itself that, you know, a parishioner's donation for charity is being invested in a Harrods warehouse. But the guy who ran that fund did the investment is a guy named Enrico Crasso, who since 1993 has been investing the Vatican money. So he's had a longstanding relationship. He had a shell company. Well, he opened a Florida LLC called HP Finance. If you create the offshore business in a locale that has low taxes and you domicile it there, then you're paying a lower tax rate. And in Miami, another advantage is if you die you're a non-resident alien, you pay a much higher estate tax. You don't get all the exemptions that American citizens might. So there are kind of legitimate reasons why a foreigner who's invested in Miami may want to go do something. Crasso maintains that HP Finance, which is on the leases that we have, the deeds, that he didn't use Vatican money to buy that. But how would you know? How do you prove that?
Right, right. This is a fascinating story in of itself. And again, the cardinal was ousted by Pope Francis last year for allegedly misspending money. Again, money that was supposed to help the poor going to spend on very lavish things. Let me wrap on this with both of you. Kevin, first of all, I mean, you know, how common do we see from the Pandora Papers? Do we know that, again, the super wealthy are doing these things? Is it just certain people, or is it anybody who has a lot of money?
Well, again, to answer that, I think you have to break it down by country. I mean, I think most Americans with money aren't doing that, most American citizens, because, again, the tax code favors them. Most Ecuadorians with money, I felt like in the Panama Papers, anybody who had a pulse and more than $10 in their pocket seemed to have a shell company in Ecuador. So I think, you know, places where that are unstable tend to have a higher uptake of these sorts of things. And those, you know, I would break it down by country. A lot of the Brazilian wealthy have it as well, offshore. And, you know, so there are a lot of things that go into it, but it's ultimately the people who lose are everyone else in these countries, because that's tax money that's not collected. It often is the graft and favoritism, all the things that the United States spends a lot of money in terms of foreign aid and drug policy trying to combat as well.
And so, you know, when you look at the Pandora Papers, really, Kevin, this information How can it be used? What can happen next?
Well, and I think law enforcement was slow initially on the Pandora. I think in the Panama Papers, there was a feeling like maybe this was stolen information. We don't want to use this in a court of law. We need to have it independently verified. I think at this point, that's kind of gone by the wayside. And in fact, it has become a tool for the Justice Department and prosecutors around the world to go after these things. The Venezuelan ones that Antonio has followed are by far the most labyrinthian and complex. And, you know, the Venezuelans seem to have invented every single way you can siphon money and ways that you never thought possible they've invented.
Yeah. And Antonio, briefly, if you could, you know, because you're looking at Venezuela anyway, what did the Pandora Papers show you? Anything new that you didn't know about how Maduro and others are siphoning that money in other places, taking the country's wealth away from the people?
Yeah, it's given us more pieces of the puzzle. This is a very long process trying to track down all this money. And, you know, the people linked to the regime, by the way, have taken out billions and billions of dollars in wealth out of the nation's coffers. And that's one of the main reasons there's a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, which has led to more than 6 million people deciding to pack their bags and actually sometimes walk to neighboring Colombia and walk to, you know, even places as far as Chile and Argentina. They bankrupted the economy just to be able to keep taking money out of the nation. And it's tracking down this money has been a gigantic effort. There's been a number of specializing journalists that we do this, and the Pandora Papers has given us new tools and new trails and new tips, and we're following those to be able to develop this ongoing story.
Again, that was Kevin Hall, the North American editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and Antonio Delgado, who covers Venezuela for El Nuevo Herald. Now, you can find more of the Miami Herald's reporting on the Pandora Papers on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, Miami-Dade is redrawing its district map. How will that affect you in the next election? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's no secret that more people are moving to South Florida. The 2020 census data shows Miami-Dade County is seeing rapid residential growth, specifically in South Miami-Dade. Now, with those changes, it means it's time for the county to redraw its district map. Miami Herald reporter Doug Hanks has been covering the story, joins us now. Doug, always great to have you. Why does the county have to adjust the district boundaries? I mean, did we see that big of a shift in the population?
Well, this is happening across the country after the census came out. There's federal rules for it and state and local. So what happens is it's not just population growth, but it's population shift within the county, because one of the main rules is there's 13 commission districts and they should represent roughly the same amount of people. So as some areas grow, then that causes issues in that district and in other districts.
And that this is going to go into effect for the 2022 election. How many commissioners are going to have to run for re-election, I should say, in 22?
Let's see. It'll be, I think, six. It's about, you know, it's generally half the commission. Well, no, wait a minute. Did you say run for re-election?
Yeah, how many have to rerun? Or, well, I should say will rerun or have to run because their districts are going to change.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, first of all, another rule for redistricting is you protect the incumbent because they don't want to redraw a district and then have a sitting commissioner not live in that district. So that won't happen. So what you will have is sitting commissioners deciding what their districts will look like to run for re-election. Now, it happens to be that 2022 is kind of the final year where we'll have term limits kick in for longtime commissioners. Hmm. So people like Rebecca Sosa, Javier Soto, term limits are finally kicking in for them. So there'll be quite a few open seats in 2022. And these open seats will be for redrawn commission districts.
And looking at the map that it was posted up in your story, very colorful map, by the way, and I kind of like that. Are we talking about very drastic changes to the boundaries?
It doesn't seem to be so. And by the way, the mapping is very difficult. I mean, everyone involved is complaining that it's a PDF, you have to zoom in. But anyway, we do our best. Not drastic changes. And a lot of the districts that seem gerrymandered, like there's little teeny skinny parts of them, and then they go out into larger areas, remain. But the little changes can make a big deal in elections, and they can also make a big deal for neighborhoods. It's very early, so we don't really know where the controversies are going to be, but certainly one is in the North Miami Beach area. There's an Orthodox Jewish community that's currently entirely represented by Sally Hayman in District 4. But part of that would be split up under this draft map with District 2 and Jean Monestein. So she's very upset about that, and we had some members of the residents of the neighborhood speak out against it as well.
Yeah,
we don't want that split up.
What have you been hearing from the commissioners about this first map?
Well, everyone has, not everyone, but there are gripes for sure, because every commissioner won their district, right? So they don't really, they like the status quo for the most part. But also there's concerns like Raquel Regalado. She right now is the only commissioner representing South Miami under the proposed changes. A little bit of South Miami would go over to District 6, Rebecca Sosa. And so the general consensus seems to be you're better off, if you can, having one commissioner for one city. Now, Miami will never, ever have that, right? It's too big. But for the smaller cities, it's possible.
You know, the thing, too, is that commissioners still have to, there's still time. They're going to be talking about this. There's going to be a vote on it. And the public, they can have a say in it, too.
Yes. If you go on to MiamiDade.gov or just search MiamiDade redistricting, it pops up pretty easily. There's a website, a county website that has all these maps and the documents along with new dates for, there's going to be one meeting in all 13 districts, right? So it goes on for a while in October and into November.
We're speaking with Miami Herald reporter Doug Hanks, MiamiDade County's new redistricting plans. Right now they're talking about it, and you could, by the way, you could check out his story on our social media, WLRN Sundial, and as we mentioned, there's a very colorful map there of the districts and some of the proposed changes so that you could see what they're talking about. But again, it's not finalized, and so there's still time for people to speak up about this. And again, you can find out more about it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I was looking at it. Districts 8 and 9 saw the largest increase in residents, both in South Miami-Dade. Both of those districts grew by more than 75,000 people from the last census. Are those the biggest changes? Where else are we seeing massive movement?
Right. In general, it's been a shift from the northeast to the south. That's kind of the trends they're trying to fix. Now, District 2 also, which is Jean Monestein, also had a pretty big growth, and so did the western district of Pepe Diaz, like in the Doral area. So it's kind of everywhere. It's not everywhere, but it is in different places. But District 8 and 9 are the main targets for the population, for redistributing some population. They have some of the biggest problems to be fixed.
And by the way, who's making the map? Who's redrawing this?
It's a consulting firm out of Virginia that does this.
Okay.
And they, they get paid to make a recommendation. They meet separately with the commissioners who lobby, complain, whatnot, and some suggestions are definitely taken, some are not, as we've seen. I mean, Sally Hayman came to the first citizens advisory meeting and said, I will campaign against this map. So, and she's one of 13 votes to approve it. So it should get interesting. One thing to watch is the demographic breakdown, which they really haven't gotten into in the public process yet. But the population growth of the Black population has not really kept pace with growth in other segments. And so you are seeing some districts that were majority population Black, right? Not voter, that they haven't really gotten into that yet, lose that status. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
So I'm wondering, you know, with how this is going to be, so people understand, you know, how this is going to be finalized. Again, there's going to be opportunity for the public to speak up, and then there's going to be a vote. How long is that process?
I think it's supposed to be done by the end of the year. So relatively short time frame. Doesn't have to be, though, I don't think.
And, you know, does the map have to meet specific federal or state or local criteria?
It does. I mean, there's lots of kind of principles involved in terms of representation of minority groups that the courts say need to be protected. It's kind of the opposite of gerrymandering is all the communities of interest are in one district or another. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, these shouldn't be drawn for political purposes. I mean, of course, they all are, but it shouldn't be so aggressively drawn for political purposes that it doesn't make sense to have a district cut a community in half or cut a city in half, because it's just not efficient. You want to be able to go to one commissioner if you can and say, I have a problem with what the county's doing.
And as you pointed out, because the census came out, it's just this is happening, you know, all over. And we know the state, by the way, right now is working on its redistricting, congressional redistricting maps as well. But I wondered if in the past, you know, there were any issues or these processes go relatively smoothly.
Right. The last time the county did this, there wasn't a big controversy. But this time around, we'll see.
We shall see, because in Miami-Dade, it doesn't ever get boring, that's for sure. And as you pointed out, people could just go to Miami.gov and see for themselves when those meetings are and how they could participate.
Right. Miami-Dade.gov, you could eventually find it, but I would just Google Miami-Dade redistricting. It does pop up pretty easily.
Again, Miami Herald reporter Doug Hanks, follow his reporting on the redrawing of these maps, and you'll see, again, it hasn't changed, so don't worry, you're not voting for anything different yet, but we'll keep following this story, and again, you can go check it out for yourself if you want to speak up, because maybe you're in one of those neighborhoods and the line is shifting, or they may be proposing it, and you could say something, so, you know, there's your opportunity. Doug, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
A Black-owned farm in West Palm Beach is fighting for its future. The city of West Palm Beach has decided not to renew the land lease for the Henrietta Bridge Farm, which is located near the historic Northwest neighborhood. This decision could worsen the area's food desert situation. WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus brings us this story.
Okay, at the north end of the property is the fruit forest. There are 53 tropical fruit trees up there. Avocado, mango, breadfruit, sapodilla, things like that.
Stuart Bosley is the founder of Henrietta Bridge Farm. It sits on an acre and a half of land near the historic Northwest neighborhood. He shows me a 72-foot structure he built called a hoop house.
A hoop house is it protects the plants from the intense sunlight. You know, it gets to be really, really hot out here during the summer.
A man hired to cut grass clears his way around irrigation lines in the raised bed garden, several yards across from the Native American Cheeky Hut.
So that was put in by people authorized by the Seminole Tribe of Florida.
Wow. This place is not just a farm, but also a laboratory for kids learning about the environment and a source of second chances where people who've been incarcerated can get a job. But Henrietta Bridge Farm is almost certainly going away soon.
That means what I have in growing trays, seedling trays, and what's in the ground. I have to pull all that up and really just disassemble the farm, take it down. The banana patch, the trees, the flowering plants, everything.
The city of West Palm Beach owns the land, and officials recently decided not to renew Bosley's lease. The mayor wants to use the space to house the homeless instead. Bosley is 78 and a Vietnam veteran. His Native American and Black family members ran farms across the Midwest for many years. The native New Yorker says that's why he's passionate about providing healthy food for his community. Bosley feels defeated.
There are few Black farmers in America. There used to be many, many, but that's just not happening.
The farm has been providing fresh produce to low-income, predominantly Black communities for 7 years. Members of the community spoke on behalf of the farm at recent city commission meetings.
Mr. Bosley has pioneered the concept of urban farms in West Palm Beach.
I wanted to let you know that I was there the day we planted those trees.
I just think we need to be advocating for an expansion on projects like his and really look at what we can do to not only uplift him, but duplicate it.
Bosley says without his farm,
people have to go 2 miles in any direction to get fresh produce. This community, these communities are have low automotive ownership, so they have to depend on public transportation or private cars to get to where the larger grocery stores are, and those ones are 2 miles away. Our main interest is to provide fresh produce to those people, teach them how to grow food, and pretty much just be the center for food distribution to that community. It's low income, primarily Black and Hispanic, primarily Black actually. We put down collard greens, mustard greens, okra, kale, cabbage, tomatoes, green bell peppers, some beans. All of the foods that are culturally relevant to the community that we service.
During our visit to the farm, you said this was an effort to change eating habits. What did you mean by that?
A little bit of green will help you with the hypertension, heart disease, obesity, all of the ailments that are common within the Black community.
This is our veggie van, and we were using that to deliver produce to the seniors. And
I put 10 years into this thing. I spent thousands of dollars.
Bosley is speaking at a recent commission meeting. It's his last attempt to convince city officials to let him hold on to the farm.
By the time you guys do anything for whatever this new project is, I would have had two cycles of providing fresh produce to the families around the farm.
Let me address this Henrietta Farm situation.
This is West Palm Beach Mayor Keith James at the same commission meeting.
One of the key priorities of this administration has been providing housing, addressing the homeless issue. That property is the largest property that the city owns.
James wants to build a transitional housing project for people who are experiencing homelessness.
And I am committed to that, and we'll move forward.
And he says his administration will start a new urban farm somewhere else.
That was WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus. You can find a link to photos and more of his reporting on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. By the way, just a reminder that you can always stay in touch with us real easily via our text club, the Sundial Text Club. Just send us your thoughts, your comments, your questions. Start by typing the word hello and send it to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. This is the easiest way for you to keep in touch with us about any of the segments that you hear. You can also share ideas of stories that we should be covering. Well, still to come, we're going to look at new research that shows how fish pee might help coral reefs. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The coral and seagrass in our oceans are a lifeline to our ecosystem. But we've all heard the stories. These underwater forests are threatened by pollution, warming waters, and of course, coastal development. The answer to those threats might be found in an unlikely place, fish pee. It actually has life-sustaining nutrients that can help. Joining us now is Will Weed. He's a PhD student at Florida International University's Institute of Environment, and he's studying just that, fish waste. Will, so great to have you. Thanks so much.
Hi, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, so Will, is it fair to say that fish are like underwater gardeners?
Yeah, you know, just like you and I may put cow manure or some kind of fertilizer on our garden, the fish waste itself is actually a vital source of these nutrients that gets used by seagrass as well as corals here locally.
All right, you know, Will, I'm going to admit that I did not realize that fish urinate.
You know, and you're not alone on that. When I talk to people about my work, oftentimes that's something that people are sort of shocked at. Oh, fish pee. And it's like, yeah, you're actually swimming through the fish pee. And it's really an important link in the nutrient cycling for our tropical systems here.
All right. Now, we've had a lot of discussions about, you know, sewage and its effect on Biscayne Bay. But let's make a distinction. Fish waste is very different from the waste that we're putting out there, human waste, right?
Yes, that's correct. So something that's really special about the fish excretion or fish pee is the form that it comes out. And so the type of ammonium and phosphorus that we see in this waste matter is biologically available and easily utilized by these primary producers, where the other waste that you're talking about is usable, but it often has to go through some microbial changes in order to be taken up.
Tell me about how you study this. You know, what's the process? I mean, you're going out catching these fish or you're studying them in the wild. How are you doing this?
So currently my work is focused here in Biscayne Bay. And what I do is I go out and I collect fish using a variety of methods, from seine nets to rod and reel. And I catch different species of fish and I essentially put them in what we call an incubation chamber. And in this chamber, we have filtered water that we test the nutrients at the beginning. We then put the fish into the chamber. We wait a period of time, and then we sample the water afterwards. So then what I can do is do some calculations between the beginning and the end to say, this is the amount of nitrogen and this is the amount of phosphorus that the fish has contributed over this period of time. So basically, I take fish and I put them in plastic bags and test their water.
And you wait for them to pee because you have to see what kind of nutrients are putting in that water.
Exactly. And so right now, the methodology is a little bit up in the air. We're basing our methods off of some work on freshwater fish. So that's something I'm actually kind of exploring, but we typically keep them for about 30 minutes.
How did you get into this research? This is so fascinating. It really is.
Yeah, you know, I never would have thought that I would be getting my PhD in pee. As a woman I spoke to the other day said I put the pee in PhD, which I thought was great. So it's something that I was working. I was fortunate enough to work with the Smithsonian down in Panama for several years. And I noticed all these little smaller planktivorous fish. And I was wondering, you know, without the big fish here, what are the little guys doing to contribute to the nutrient cycling? And so I kind of began to answer these questions and ran this little experiment, which I'm in the process of hopefully getting published here soon. And that kind of was the springboard into this whole world of consumer mediated nutrients, you know, how these consumers that we typically think of as eating stuff are actually fertilizing stuff.
You were in the Keys recently, right? You were actually doing some work with sharks.
Yeah. So last week I got to work with another fellow FIU student here, Megan Kelly, in the PEC lab, working with nurse sharks. And so it was super exciting, as where I typically focus with reef fishes, I got to go out and we were catching some nurse sharks and basically putting them in really, really big plastic bags. And I have the samples sitting right next to me in a freezer ready to be analyzed. And so that'll kind of be another chapter or another piece of the work is not only these reef fishes, but what are these bigger megafauna doing as well as far as nutrient cycling?
And I mean, do we have a sense of, you know, how much of the nutrients that they're putting into the water is really helpful to the coral, to the seagrasses? Like, you know, could it save them? Really, because that's the question we're looking at now, is that enough to save them?
So I don't know if we really necessarily know that at this point, but what we do know is there's been studies where they compare a coral head where grunts go and hang out, you know, a very common fish here for us. And they're living on the coral heads, and they actually live on the same coral head and repeat going to that same spot. And that coral head has been shown to have increased growth, increased fat stores. And so in the face of potentially a bleaching event or some kind of disturbance, they're healthier and are a little bit more resilient. So we do know that, but we don't know exactly to what extent, you know, these nutrients are going to help to mitigate against these changes.
I'm speaking with Will Weed. He's a PhD student at Florida International University's Institute of Environment. He is studying literally right now fish pee and how it can help the coral and the seagrass in our ecosystem. And by the way, you can find photos and links to more of his work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Will, you know, we talk about this a lot too, obviously, with climate change and warming seas. And I'm wondering, you know, with the fish communities, you know, how has this been impacting them? You know, because you're looking at how they could have an impact on the coral, but how is all this, the change that we're seeing, how is it impacting them?
Yeah, globally, we are definitely seeing changes in fish communities. And there's kind of two main drivers that I'm particularly interested in, one of which is, you know, how changing as a result of fishing is going to change fish community structure, and then how that's going to impact the nutrients that that community cycles. So essentially, if we go out and we target all the nice, big, beautiful snapper that we want to eat, well, now they're no longer there. And so how is that going to shift the nutrients that they once provided via their excretion to something different? And then the other kind of aspect that I'm looking at is this phenomenon called tropicalization. And so what's happening is, as our oceans are warming, these subtropical and tropical fish are able to expand polewards because they're no longer limited by that colder regime. And so as these fish are moving, so for us, tropical fish are moving up the coast of Florida, we don't really actually know what is happening or how these new fish in this, quote, novel community are shifting the nutrients and how they're delivered within a system. So that's something that I'm really interested in exploring a little bit further, as it is something that is happening here locally up and down the West Coast, as well as on the Gulf side of Florida.
You've seen some of those changes already happening, like way over on the other side, like Japan and Australia, haven't you?
Yeah, so not me personally, but there is some research going on and some pretty well-published stuff about how these fish communities are in once kelp forest areas are now kind of this barren or shifting even towards coral reefs. And so people often associate tropical fish with increased herbivory, or, you know, they eat a lot more than their temperate relatives. And so that has been associated with, okay, these tropical fish, they're consumers, so they're eating away the kelp forest. What I'm kind of interested in is, okay, yes, they're doing this, but also how they are recycling and how they're moving and interacting between these systems is different. And so what are the implications on that, on the nutrients that they then provide?
I'm wondering what, you know, what sparked your passion for this kind of work? Because my understanding is you weren't born near the water.
Yeah, I grew up landlocked in the Northeast, and kind of was lucky enough to come down to Florida once a year for vacation with the family. And it was my exposure to the ocean. And I kind of was like, man, how do I make it so I always have to be by the ocean? And so I ended up doing my undergrad at Stony Brook University up in Long Island, studying marine science. And because it's always been something I knew I wanted to focus on. And I've always had a passion for the outdoors and in particular fishing. So finding this dissertation and this kind of niche of research has really been awesome for me, because I get to do the things that I love and explore the kind of questions that I'm really interested in.
You know, I want to come back to this issue of climate change. And I mean, again, it's a topic that we've talked about a lot on this program, you know, with the threats to the coral, you know, going all the way down to the Keys. And I'm wondering, for you as a scientist, as you see that, What's your biggest fear, your biggest concern going forward into the future?
You know, I think it's similar to a lot of people. And like you're saying, we're noticing it is just not being able to enjoy it. The corals and the reefs here not only offer, you know, recreation, but they also offer us a lot of services and industry based off of it. And so as a scientist, it's really important for me to try and preserve and protect what we have because it is changing, and understanding how it's changing and why is really, really important in order to being able to protect it.
And I mean, are you seeing, or do you think that it could possibly affect your research, whether it could wipe it out or it make you force you to go somewhere else to do the research? Because as you said, fish are starting to move to other places.
Well, so for me, what I really enjoy about my research is that I'm able to work with different species of fish in different systems. Particularly the tropics are really attractive because of the diversity of fish, as well as our typical lower ambient nutrient loads as compared to a temperate area where there's typically you get seasonally higher nutrients. So with these lower nutrient levels, you then have a greater impact from these nutrients that are provided by the consumers, or the fish in this case.
You know, I was thinking about this, Will. Unlike you, I mean, I did grow up near the water. I was born on an island, so I have always had the ocean nearby. And I think, like a lot of people, you know, I take it for granted, you know, that it's it's just there. I know it's there, but you know, I don't spend a lot of time at it. But what do you think? What do you wish more people would know and understand about the ocean and its appreciation of it?
Yeah, I think that something personally for me is that it seems so big and vast, but every little piece matters. Every little contribution makes a big difference, and it all comes together to tell a big story. So, you know, my research is just one piece of this puzzle as far as the nutrients, and then there's more work to be done on how that then gets absorbed by which species of coral and that kind of stuff. And so for your average person, it's kind of each fish that you decide to keep that's, you know, within the right size range, or each lobster that you don't put back that's a gravid female, you know, that does have an effect on the overall vastness of the ocean, even though your actions may seem really, really small. So to me, it's that every person's individual actions kind of ripple throughout the whole system.
Yeah. So where's the research now, or what's the next thing that you're going to be working on with?
So hopefully I will be trying to continue some of the shark work, dealing with some larger nurse sharks, as well as doing some work down in the Keys, looking at how fish movement and how they're kind of connecting a system. So if it's feeding on the coral reef during the day and sheltering in the seagrass bed, or vice versa, how are these movements linking the nutrient systems?
You know, I picture you, like, maybe you spend a little bit of your time in an actual office, but a lot of it out in the water. Is that true? Is that right?
I pictured that too, and unfortunately, it's not quite how it works out. I would say it's probably, 20% in the field, and then a lot of the time sitting in the office, or for me in the lab. I do a lot of pipetting work trying to quantify the nutrients and to be able to actually say, you know, yes, the fish peed, and this is how much it peed, and this is what kind of nutrients it released.
Well, just make sure that on your business card, you put that down. You put the P in PhD. That's all that
matters.
Isn't
that brilliant? Yeah. This lovely lady just suggests that to me. I was like, I'm going to steal that from you. So wherever you are in the world, nice lady. Thank you.
Will Weed, PhD student at Florida International University's Institute of Environment. Again, find out more about his research on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Will, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, and that's our program for this Tuesday, October 12th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to be looking at a small community in Boca Raton called Dixie Manor. It's a predominantly Black community that could soon be razed for more housing. Now, this community has a long history dating back to World War II. What happens when development erases history and also forces people out of their homes? Also, the city of Miami is once again tackling homelessness, but is the new effort just criminalizing those who are experiencing homelessness? And finally, it's October and Halloween is almost here. Are you going back out to the haunted house attractions? We're going to look at one Halloween show and the need that we have to feel scared, because every now and then a good jolt of fear is good for you. By the way, don't forget that we are reading Carl Hiaasen's Squeeze Me for the Sundial Book Club for the month of October. Just look up Sundial Book Club on Facebook and post your questions. We're going to be talking with Carl in a taped interview on Friday, so you could post your questions there on Facebook. We'd love to have them, and our authors always love the questions that the readers come up with. So again, we're going to be talking with them on Friday, so you can post your questions if you've been reading the books, or maybe you're just a big fan of Carl's and you've always had a question you want to ask him. Post it there and I'll make sure to get it to him. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.